Welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are teaching people the power of ethical-only persuasion. What a concept. Making a difference in your ability to make a difference. I don't know. I like slogans, taglines. I write a lot of them. My name is Dr. Dan French, American rhetorician, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor. Also stand-up comedian and comedy writer from late night in Hollywood. So I mix the intellectual and the comedy. That's kind of my game. If you want to get some jokes, go find us on social media. I tweet jokes all day long, especially at Twitter, at Rhetoric War. Here are a couple of things I wrote recently. I really like Top List. I used to write for Letterman, and you know, he was the king of Top List. And I think they're really great little joke baskets. So here's something I thought of this week. I think Trump's going to be looking for something to do post-presidency while he waits around to be incarcerated. So thought maybe he wanted to star in some top Donald Trump rom-com remakes. And so here are some of the titles. Soulless in Seattle. Lies, Actually, I think would be good. 175,000 Things I Hate About You. You've Got Trials. My Best Friend's Treason. While You Were Creeping. And 16 Scandals. So there's some jokes for you. The podcast, if you haven't listened before, is where I do three things. I convert conservatives, bring them on here and talk them into changing their minds. I talk to comedians about their politics. Always interesting what those brains have going on. And I get in and glean interesting stuff from persuasion pros and influence professionals. You can always visit us at rhetoricwarriors.com. Sign up for our master course in persuasion. Join Rhetoric Warriors and you get 2 free weeks of the master course. Or jump in and take our new course, Converting Conservatives. Change the world by converting one conservative at a time. That's my new program, Convert One Conservative. So let's jump into our this week with our guest. My guest this week is Emily Deans, a psychiatrist. And she's certified in Texas and Massachusetts, two of the more aggro states, I think. So she's got her stuff together. She's a clinician. She's been a Harvard instructor. I think you still instruct, don't you? You still teach?
Yep. Okay. Gosh, 10 years now, I think.
All right. She specializes in psychopharmacology, somatoform disorders. Is that still right? I pulled this off your bio. I looked up somatoforms. I like it. We'll talk about that. And I met Emily originally at PaleoFX when we were on a panel together about how to change the way people eat, like how to talk to them about changing their diets. And so always enjoyed her. I think she's a cool person, super smart. So welcome, Emily Deans.
Well, thank you for having me. Yeah, so I am originally from Texas and did my undergraduate in biology at the University of Texas in Austin and my medical school degree at University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. And then I went up to Harvard for, Harvard. For my residency in psychiatry, which is an additional 4 years. And then I married a Yankee, so I'm up here still.
Wow, you got drug up.
But I do a lot of, talking, and my entire job as a psychiatrist is persuasion. We have a lot of experience with that and meeting people where they are and talking to people from, that's the great part of my job is I have people every walk of life from a CEO, to the guy who fixed your furnace to, unemployed and on disability. I mean, and all sorts of different political persuasions, even up here in Massachusetts, where I don't think we have any Republican congressmen at all in the federal government. But, we're still 30-40% Republicans like every state. That's when people say, oh, there's going to be a civil war. I'm kind of like, are the rural areas going to rise up against the cities? I mean, I don't quite get split
yeah,
up by the
there's
states.
No, yeah, the North-South distinction doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
There'd be, other people from the farms coming in to get the people who buy from the farms.
I guess so.
So you're Massachusetts. Why is Massachusetts so blue? Like I've got a lot of friends over the years from the East Coast, but I've never lived there. So why is it such a democratic place?
I mean, I would say it's probably the Kennedy influence still. And a lot of, I mean, the biggest employer here is Partners Healthcare. So in tons of higher education, so very highly educated. This is like the whole state is the suburb, basically. And the suburb has kind of become the new blue. So, but what's actually fascinating about Massachusetts is that with the last, I think 2018 was when I really looked, the senatorial race, you know, the counties that voted the most for Elizabeth Warren also voted the most for Charlie Baker, who's our Republican governor. But, you know, I'm from Texas, so in Massachusetts, I'm sort of center right. In Texas now, I'm like a flaming hippie communist. But, you know, I'm fairly centrist. I actually really like Charlie Baker, our governor. I come from, again, from this sort of Texas stock where you sort of take responsibility for yourself. You don't really trust government. You don't really trust bureaucracy. I thought the Texas Constitution idea of making an entirely weak executive was a great idea. And I don't know why we don't do that in the federal government, to be honest. But
we'll talk about that. What do you say that about Texas? That you like that idea. What do you like about it?
The governor can't just go in and make executive orders and screw up everything for everybody. You got to screw up everybody with a cadre of your friends. So
that's the idea of a republic, right? That you got to get a small group of people who have power as opposed to one person who has power. You're just spreading the power out, you know, from every political system that you switch it to. It goes from emperor to republic to democracy. You know, how far do we want to spread it?
Yeah. And, you know, there's corruption in every system. And, you know, what I really like is transparency and a decrease of corruption. So whatever incentives we can put in there to reduce corruption is kind of where I would like to be. And I'd rather err on the side of few people getting some money they don't deserve than people starving in the streets. So that's kind of my political perspective. And from the mental health perspective, you know, you can't count on charitable contributions to take care of the mentally ill. We need a robust healthcare system for that. And so that sort of working in this for so many years has turned me a little bit more left than I was when I left Texas back when I was young. Not old.
Well, I think those industries, right? Whenever you come into direct contact with need populations, there's no way to not start empathizing. You know, I think the difference, like, you know, cops and people in the military and stuff like that, they end up getting the worst experience of people in need. You know, when people are acting out and when they, you know, commit crimes because they, you know, come from these sort of backgrounds, and they end up with horrible ideas about humanity. But if you're in there getting to know people, like in social work or even teaching and things like that, where you get, you know, over long-term experience with these people, you start to understand it with a completely different, you know, mindset. And so, like, I think when you get into those professions, they do kind of turn you into a bleeding heart in some ways, right?
Right. So doctors are sort of a funny anthropologic experiment in political, you know, that surgeons tend to be right-wing. And you go down and by professions, like psychiatrists are the second most left wing of any doctors. Now we work with a very, you know, underserved population. I think that's why. And then the most left wing doctors are actually infectious disease specialists who tend to work in public health.
Sure.
You know, people who have TB, STDs, immigrants coming up with parasites and things like that. So they worked with the most underserved population. So you can see why they would be the most left-wing of any physicians.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like, I think this is the thing when you look at the splits between the rural and the city, like you can't live in a city and not experience other people.
Right.
I used to say about Los Angeles that I don't see how anybody can be a racist in Los Angeles because I moved there from the South. I'm like, you would be exhausted in Los Angeles, you know, if you were a racist, and you'd be confused. You wouldn't even know who to hate. I mean, there's so many people there. You're like, I don't even know what you are. Like, you're from Mozambique. I don't know what that is. you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, in the rural, like I grew up in Kentucky and I was on the border of the city and the, you know, the country. And, you know, I had lots of friends who grew up incredibly rural and they don't, you just don't meet anybody outside your group very often. And so it's real easy to see, you know, strangers and difference and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, that is something that this country has to deal with at some point, right?
Yeah. You know, certainly I think I was listening to a podcast today and I think they were saying that 50% of the kids born today are not white, you know, and we are multicultural. We've always been a multicultural country, even, you know, in the founding when it was, you know, people from Ireland and people from Scotland and people from, you know, Germans and Jewish people, they and Quakers, they didn't get along. They were sort of like different races back then. And, you know, every day is the same day and we have these same fights and these same discussions century after century. And the only thing that sort of makes me feel better about what's going on right now is, you know, reading, you know, history and learning about history. Because you see all this happened before. I can read a book on the 1918 flu and all the same wild, irresponsible rhetoric about masks, about spreading the flu, about herd immunity. It all happened back then. And, you know, the flu did not go away with herd immunity. The flu went away because the flu mutates. You know, there's no, measles didn't go away with herd immunity. Polio didn't go away with herd immunity. Smallpox didn't go away with herd immunity. They all went away with vaccines. So, you know, you see just the same rhetoric, these same mistakes that humans make over and over. And it kind of helps you just sort of step back and say, okay, that's how we're programmed. We're programmed to kind of be in denial. We're programmed to not want to change, and it kind of helps to have empathy with that stance, helps you not be so frustrated with it, which helps you communicate more to people who have that other stance, both politically and about biology.
Well, and I think, you know, you use the term rhetoric there in the way that most people use the term rhetoric, which is empty talk, you know, that it's done with negatively to carry forth, you know, something that's a kind of an ugly agenda. And that's the dominant, you know, understanding of rhetoric. It's just because we're not trained in rhetoric anymore. You know, Americans in general never take a course in persuasion or rhetoric. So they don't understand that, you know, it's really the study of all public messaging. It's the study of effective public messaging. And so, like, when you see stuff like that, like what you just did there with going back in and rescuing history and saying history gives me, you know, this perspective so that I can look at things differently. You know, that is also, that's a nice little piece of rhetoric, you know, to bring up 1918 and the flu and give people a context so that now they can go, oh, well, maybe I don't have to be so scared about all this crazy behavior going on because it's happened before and it's natural in these kind of human situations.
Right. And,
you know, that's sort of my purpose in a lot of this stuff is to explain to people that, you know, when you're trying to get change, when you're trying to progress people, maybe from red to blue or from rural to city, you're trying to get more education, then you do that with messaging. And if it's really good messaging, sometimes it can do that for people, which I think is the power of psychiatry. You know, psychiatry has a great story. It has tons of great stories behind it. Like even the story of Freud, you know, everybody's like, you know, he's been discredited. I'm like, he has this most powerful story that most people understand psychiatry through. Because he was a character, you know, the cigar and you can see his face and all that stuff. And that's how people start to understand your profession. So
Freud was a brilliant writer, a brilliant guy. And what I love about Freud is that, you know, science was very different back then. We tend to think of the scientific principles and hypotheses and those kinds of things as sort of immutable, but it really wasn't. You know, it wasn't until the 1960s that people even understood you needed a placebo control. And it wasn't until 2006, I think, that they required people to register the trial in advance of doing the trial, which means people had to register their endpoints and things before doing the trial instead of making up their endpoints based on the data that they got.
Right.
So that was only, you know, 15 years ago. So, you know, this modern idea of what is sort of exquisite science is very different than what Freud did. And Freud made a lot of mistakes, but a lot of his writing was actually, hey, help me understand how I fucked this up. Bart, is this an explicit podcast? I'm sorry.
Go for it. Yeah, I am a comedian, so it's got to be explicit.
Right. So, you know, he gets a lot of heat for his Dora. He wrote up this case study of a young woman who was basically sexually abused by her employer, and she ended up having this somatic symptom of her hand going numb, and Freud conceptualized it because she was touching the forbidden penis, and, you know, and she got worse with his treatment, and he wasn't able to get her better, and he wrote it up saying, wow, I really missed the boat on this one. And what he really missed is that he's this Victorian male who doesn't understand sexual abuse and any kind of comprehension. And when you read it with that kind of thought about it, you realize, you know, he's kind of ahead of his time, because he put out this failure. If you read it sort of from a feminist perspective, you're like, whoa, what an idiot. And, you know, and so, you know, you can't really be a psychiatrist and not kind of have a love hate relationship with Freud, but sure. It was really his timing and ignorant and, you know, how he learned that why you hate him. He was really a thoughtful and brilliant guy.
Yeah. And I've read, you know, some Freud with, even with comedy, like, the Collective Unconscious, or I can't remember the exact title, but he wrote something about comedy and trying to understand how that worked. And, you know, like, you're right. You see this anachronistically. You're looking, you know, from where you are way back to somebody that's feeling around in the dark, you know, at the early stages of learning about something, and you criticize backwards. It's not very interesting to me to hear people do that. It's more interesting what you just did, which is to, you know, recover what you can from there, understand the context, take the good stuff and just leave the other stuff there. And it's like, fine, it wasn't ready, you know, but
yeah,
you know, you can go back and still find value.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, you brought up psychiatry. It's sort of what we do in persuasion. And this brings up some sort of conversations that I've had on Twitter recently. And so there's a twofold communications package on Twitter. One is a lot of people go on social media, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, to rant. And people confuse that for persuasion and communication. And it's not, you can't rant.
Yeah, I mean, it's monologue communication. It's just a blare. Yeah.
A spectacular rant is not going to convince anybody who's not on your side. You know, already we know that. And I think that's actually a wonderful, you know, shoot, I go on Twitter all the time to rant, you know, I love Twitter. And then that's very separate than like a persuasive public health message or a smart public health message, or what I do, you know, with patients. You know, psychiatrists and doctors persuade people all the time. You say, oh, you know, Mr. Johnson, Mrs. Smith, maybe you want to stop drinking so much. Maybe you want to stop smoking. Maybe you want to lose some weight. You know, we're always doing these sort of difficult, big lifestyle changes. And the only way to do that is to meet people where they are. And you cannot do that by arguing with them. If you argue with them, they just dig in on their side. So you have to stop, sit, let them tell you where they are, and then you use a very personalized message to very slowly ooch them along the stages of change. So that's, in psychiatry, it's called motivational interviewing, and that's how we would do it. I mean, just as a very sort of basic example, I'll do one medical example, and then I'll do actually a political example. So a medical example is I might be in the emergency room and some guy has been in a car accident. And he also has bronchitis, and the car accident is because he was drunk and the bronchitis is because he smokes. And so you talk to him, hey, how are you doing? Hey, okay, we're going to give you these antibiotics, and they've, you know, splinted your leg and blah, 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 blah. And they brought me in psychiatry because you were drinking a lot before you came in. And hey, do you think that you know, you got in the accident. Was it because of your drinking? Yeah, doc, you know, I really just had too much. And that gives me an intro to then say, how long have you, you know, listening to him, knowing where he is, not being judgmental, just saying, hey, this is where we are right now. Let's talk about the situation. What can we do to change? Have you ever tried to stop before? What have you done? Did this work? Did that not work? Lots of things don't work. You know, not judging anything, just saying, hey, here's where we are. Is there a problem that we can solve together that we're agreeing on? And from a political perspective, you know, I have so many patients who come in who are not talking to their parents or their kids, or their kids are not talking to them because one or the other is involved in a different political spectrum, and they don't understand that, you know, in the today's media environment, people get they're speaking an entirely different language. You know, on the right, Black Lives Matter is a Marxist organization that's trying to indoctrinate people into communism. And if you run the numbers, you know, Black people aren't killed any more than white people or whatever it is, you know, but clearly, you know, we're treated differently because of our skin. There's systemic racism that's not really in question. On the left, you know, if you don't believe in Black Lives Matter, then you're a racist. And what even the heck are you doing? Why would you even argue against that? So with these people with their different silos and these different messages and no one to translate, they fight because they're like, I don't want you to be a, you know, a communist, you know, all these horrible things happen in the 20th century because of communism. And then on the left, they're kind of like, but I don't want you to be a racist and, you know, police shouldn't be killing Black people. And the thing is, people agree, police shouldn't be killing innocent people. People don't like corruption. People, you know, people actually share many of the same values, but because of the media environment that silos us and splits us in order to generate clicks and ratings, it tears families apart, and it's terrible. And I weirdly, as a psychiatrist, I find a lot of the time my job is to just simply translate these words.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a so there's two things here. I want to go back to, you know, what you call motivated listening is, you know, in my area, part of my degree is in cultural studies, and that's kind of really good, just ethnographic interviewing, right? It's information centric interviewing so that you're just gathering information. You're not evaluating it with them or anything like that. You're trying to stay that in journalism, you know, there's also a journalistic interviewing. It's this idea in interpersonal communication of other discovery and self-disclosure, you know, that dynamic that creates relationships. And you see people, they use that to move through levels of interpersonal relationships. So you start out with your best, you know, your most interesting disclosure, you know, your best stories, and then you go through the middle ones, and then you know, finally get down into the, you know, deeper, darker, kind of uglier ones, and you can sort of judge intimacy levels and relationships with that concept. And so when I teach people, you know, persuasion conversion techniques for politics, basically that's the same thing. I start with, you know, start with information. Like, just tell me where you're at. And in fact, I go from, and you probably do this too, I can tell by the way you were talking, it's not that sort of journalistic, neutral, flat interviewer. It's a motivated, interested interviewer. Like, you're right, not only not judging them, you're actually kind of, you know, giving them meta signals of, I like you, I'm interested in this is important stuff, you know.
Right, psychiatrists are nosy and we're interested in you, so yeah.
Yeah, and that gives it a nice interpersonal familiarity that when people like you, you're much more likely to tell them about you. If people are going to judge you, you're highly likely to not tell them about you. And so that's a really powerful concept. And I use it a lot in a lot of different ways when I try to train people in rhetoric. And then the second thing about that translator, what a great position to be in, you know, a hard position, because you have to speak both languages and you have to find a neutral language somewhere in between that they can accept. But what an important position to be in, especially right now.
Yeah, and I don't, what's weird is that I don't think that it necessarily exists. I feel like grandparents used to do this. I mean, you know, with the elders, wisdom.
Yeah, they would know.
Okay, we again that history. We went from here. This is how things were. We went through the 60s and the 70s and wild swings but now it's sort of, that sort of doesn't exist. There's not that person who, you know, pays attention to all the different sides and hears the different sides and talks to the different people, because we're all so siloed. And a lot of families, and I don't disagree with this strategy, but a lot of families are getting through it now by just ignoring politics altogether. But if they can't, and this is what actually I tell our receptionist, you know, to talk to people at the front. I mean, we don't have people at the front desk right now because we're all doing online, but back when they're at the front desk, you know, sometimes people who come to my clinic don't necessarily know what's appropriate to say, you know, to the receptionist in front of the entire waiting room. And so I say, always steer the conversation to sports, the weather, or traffic. Sure. And an easy turn on things. And that's what people are having to do with their relatives right now, even though there's so many important things to talk about and interesting things to talk about. That's one method, and I entirely 100% approve of it. But if you want to talk about politics with your family that doesn't agree, you can do it, but you have to listen to where they are.
Becomes in some ways a training. You know, you need training yourself before you go into this. It's like, I used to be married to a psychotherapist, so I saw a lot of this stuff from the inside. When, you know, the skills that you learn to let emotions and people's stories in some way sieve through you, you know, so you don't hold on to everything, so you don't let everything, you know, ping your emotional, you know, heartstrings, because you would just be wrecked if you did that all the time. So learning that kind of ability to listen and hold empathy in reserve, you know, not to be cold about it, but to know when to be able to turn on that switch and not, those are sort of advanced, you know, listening skills that most people aren't ever taught either. You know, they get triggered. They're like, I got these emotions, and when something comes at me, I get triggered, and there's no space in between that for them to, you know, exert that kind of professional level control. I think that you're taught, you know, a lot as a therapist and a psychiatrist, and even as an academic in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I think that's an important message that I sort of share with my med Twitter colleagues and medical colleagues who are, you know, for them, anti-maskers, holding political rallies without masks indoors, it was an existential threat. They're on the front lines all the time, seeing sick people, dying people. And for that, it was just such a personal attack that they couldn't even have the conversation. And it starts to be, you know, they go on the news and start saying, you know, you guys are terrible, horrible people for not wearing your mask, for not believing in this. And this person's just crazy or whatever it is. And that is not a successful public health message, is the problem. They were using their pulpits to rant, which is, again, fine on Twitter or Facebook for your private audience. But if you're on CNN, you know, or if you're Dr. Fauci or whatever it is, that doesn't work as a public health message. You have to come from the place of people. You know, we don't understand where we are about death. We're not exposed to it very often. We don't have infectious diseases that kill us very often. We're very privileged. We want to deny it. We want to say, hey, we have control of this. I can speak out. I don't have to put this mask on. You know, that's the human, you know, that's sort of the psychological norm in a way.
Sure.
And it really takes sort of education and standing back and sitting back and say, hey, whoa, chemistry, physics, biology, particles flying out of my mouth, breathing in, attachment. A lot of people don't have that education and can learn enough on the internet to prove you wrong,
right,
if you have a discussion with them. And so it's really about, you know, if I have a patient, for example, and a lot of them are hesitant about the vaccines, which.
Yeah. What are you doing about that? That's interesting. That's going to be a thing.
I mean, it's sort of the same way that I talk to people who don't understand the rioters in the Capitol. I say, look, if I were absorbing this media diet, my election had been stolen. We have to, you know, we won. People are taken away. Like, going to the Capitol and marching is a rational act.
Sure. protest is very American. That whole thing was very American. We have a whole tradition of political protest violence, from throwing tea in the water all the way down. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. No, it's when you come from that exposure to that kind of media diet, that protest was 100% irrational act. And there's some of the same kind of thinking behind that to the anti-mask, to the herd immunity, to all that kind of stuff that we're, it's not scientific, but it's way of asserting control and not saying that a virus is going to control my behavior. And, you know, if you really kind of are empathetic to that idea, it's a lot easier to talk to people about that. And, oh my God, are we going to put this crazy new technology vaccine in my body? And so where, again, I do very sort of personalized. So I talk about, you know, hey, actually I start with myself with sort of a personal talk about it. I said, look, I've got some patients, they're older, they're really not good with the Zoom technology. They don't like talking to me on the phone. They consider themselves cheated that I'm not meeting them in person. They think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say bullshit, but they basically think that telephone psychiatry is bullshit. And compared to in-person, for many people, it is kind of bullshit. So, you know, I have my patients that I really want to see in person that would do so much better. And we're so much more connected and we can make so much more progress in person. But in this environment, I really can't do that until we're all vaccinated. And so the reason I'm going to be, as soon as I can get it, I'm going to get that jab in my arm, is in order to kind of be able to do my job. And also just as a public health issue in general, the more jabs in arms, the faster we're out there without masks, and the faster we'll be able to talk to our loved ones and see our loved ones and back to normal. And so if you talk to people about that, people who are conscientiously driven, they will take that message. If people aren't necessarily conscientiously driven, which are many people, then I tend to talk more scientifically. I say, well, look, this isn't necessarily like the measles or tetanus. We're, to be honest, we're wandering around the world today. We're not, you're not stumbling onto rusty nails. You're not likely to be exposed to it. But this is a pandemic. You know, you're either going to be exposed to 29 or 30,000 RNA base pairs in sort of an uncontrolled infectious situation that, you know, kills 0.5 to 2% of people, more depend if you're older, and has sort of terrible long-term immune consequences that we're not entirely sure of. Or, you know, you get exposed to a very tightly controlled 3,000 RNA base pair, you know, inoculation that goes away in 36 hours, and you develop a very tightly specific immune response to it that protects you from that other infection. Like there are a few lucky people who are not going to get it, but that's our choice we have right now. And so if a lot of times, if you put it that way to a certain educated, and again, you can speak to it with different levels of people in their education, their knowledge of biology and things like that. But if you put it that way, people are like, huh, yeah, no, that makes sense. But you have to, and people like, you know, I throw this out there, the RNA vaccines don't have any adjuvants. They don't have any preservatives. You know, I'll just use those kind of phrases too, because that's right, sort of out there in that anti-vax.
So you are a rhetorician. You're cycling through script options and adjusting the script to fit the target so that you get a better outcome.
Right. So that is something that I don't think is necessarily appreciated, especially in medicine, maybe in public health, but not in medicine outside of psych, because I will definitely adjust how I sit, how I speak, my messages, not only based on like education, but if someone's more paranoid versus a narcissist versus someone who's very dependent, I will tailor how I say something to their, to where they are. I think there are some natural primary care doctors and other doctors who do this, but we're actually trained to do this in psychiatry. You know, if I have someone who is acutely paranoid, like psychotic paranoid, you're actually trained, like you don't sit across from them like me and you. You actually sit next to them.
Huh.
And you don't really talk to them. You're kind of talking out. It's like me and you against the world.
Right.
When you're talking. I don't stand over them on the, you know, you'll see a lot of doctors in the hospital. They're standing over. If someone's paranoid or scared or anxious, I'm sit down. I like, you know, you have to, that's something that we do in psychiatry. We adjust our, I mean, some people will call that manipulation, but.
No, it's straight up rhetoric.
I get three people through the day.
Yeah. It is straight up rhetoric. Rhetoric is like, what's the outcome I'm after? Who's my target? What's the best messaging I can use to get what, to communicate to them what I need to communicate to them? So it's trying to find the most effective messaging. You eliminate anything that can derail the message for no reason at all, other than the fact that you're too close or standing up, which is a ridiculous reason to lose a message, right?
Right. You know? Yeah.
So did you guys get, is that mostly, I would assume that's like, learned through the industry of psychiatry, like people have figured that out over time, and that it's then taught, you know, it's not taught as rhetoric, right? You guys don't get rhetoric training or persuasion training.
Yeah. So I think this is one of those amazing examples of academic siloing where people discover the same thing, but never sure. hear about it from each other. That's exactly what we do. We train, you know, I teach to psychiatry interviewing in the medical schools. And this is one of our sort of basic lectures about, you know, if someone's a narcissist, you get your highest level attending to talk to them. You talk about, oh, we're at Harvard, blah, 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 blah. You know, if someone is very dependent, you bring in their husband or wife with them. And you talk about these things together because they're really, and they want to be told what to do. They don't want to make decisions. So you want to empower them as much as you can to make their decisions, but you don't want to just leave them hanging because that's going to be very unempathetic to them. You want to sort of make the decision for them, but in a way that they feel like empowered to say no.
Well, in these kind of tightly scripted persuasion situations where you've got a diagnosis of somebody, right? A general idea of who they are at a depth, some kind of a depth level, you know, not just they're wearing red. Maybe they, you know, they're Republican. You gather actual information. You've got, you know, theory generated in detail over time by a lot of different people that works and doesn't work. That's trained to other people, so it can therefore be used to be effective. That's a very tight, you know, rhetorical structure.
Yeah,
that isn't, you guys don't look at it that way, but again, in my world, that's exactly what that is. You know, in my world, you look at a full rhetorical ecology, like Aristotle defined rhetoric as the, you know, choosing between the every available means of persuasion. Like if you look and see everything that's possible, what are the five things that are going to work best, and you use those. And so that's exactly what you guys have done. You know, you're like, hey, if you got a narcissist, which, you know, we're watching a president go through, you know, this stuff, and I've heard a lot of, you know, narcissist diagnosis of him and grandiosity and all these different things that sort of get thrown at him. And people are trying to figure out in politics, how do you talk to somebody like that? So part of my thing is training the left and liberals, like, how do you, you know, defuse the right? How do you fight somebody like Trump or that rhetoric? And nobody has really developed that on the left. You know, they don't really know how to go after it versus like what you guys have done is like in personal therapy. It's like, oh, you got a narcissist. Here's what you do. So you could harvest from that and do political consulting about, hey, if you're going to run up against that, here's how you do it.
You know, this is why actually some of my very favorite podcasts and things that I listen to about the situation are Never Trump Republicans. Because they know how Republicans think. Liberals aren't always very good at knowing how Republicans think or why.
Yeah, it's a complicated mindset. You know, everybody looks at it like it's just crazy. I'm like, no, that means it's complicated. You haven't been in there. You know, I lived in the South for a long time. Yeah. And I know a lot of people who are in that world. And I know why, you know, kind of much more than most people where it comes from. I've seen it. I've lived it. And so it's complicated. You have to understand it in order to be able to adjust to it. And they just get confused and then they don't, you know, come up with any technique.
Yeah, no. And the slogans and the, you know, the thing like defund the police.
Yeah, that was a clumsy one.
I understand where they're coming from. And to be honest, I actually talk to police, you know, sometimes I need them to go in and help me with someone who's in a dangerous situation or things like that. I have patients who are policemen and women. I honestly have sort of this opinion that most people are really doing the best we can. We have weakness of character that really describes bad things that happen in bad leadership sometimes. Necessarily, most people really aren't. There are a few. There's some evil people, don't get me wrong, but most people are actually decent. And if you come from that perspective, and most policemen are actually out there, they're not trying to get a high off of dominating people. They're actually in there to serve the public, you know? And so, and when you talk to most policemen, if they say, hey, you know, when you're going in this mental health situation, wouldn't you love to have a social worker with you?
Right.
They'd be like, yeah. Hell yeah.
Yeah. That'd be great.
That would be fantastic. They love it. You know, if they have to come to my office, if someone's, you know, has to be hospitalized or something, they love it that I'm there to defuse the situation, to talk to the family, to make sure that nobody's going to do something violent. And, you know, and that's not a luxury that they have all the time. They're often going in this situation without anybody who's trained for this. So this whole, like, defund the police, actually, that slogan is terrible, but the police and everybody else are on the same side. You need the social workers. You also need the security at times to come in together for many of these domestic situations.
Yeah. It's almost like it's support the police. You need more. They need more resources, right. Not less.
And trained resources. So, and so this is just an example of that same, the media siloing. You know, it's
actually have problems with the media, Emily.
I really do.
The media a few times.
I feel like a right winger. Oh, fake news. Or no, but I hate, except for Jake Tapper. I really like Jake Tapper. I hate CNN because they bring these pundits on to talk about the pandemic or factual things or this or that. They don't know what they're talking about. They just have a right or a left political side. They fight about it. Nobody has any answers. You could listen to that for 3 hours and be know less about what's going on than when you started. And that, I hate that.
Yeah, I think the media, I think I talk to people, especially because I do, you know, conversions of conservatives on here, and they all, right. You know, have the media has been well slandered on the right, you know, so, it's correct. The inherent flaws in the media are inherent flaws. They can't talk very complicated. They can't talk, you know, for very long. They have to keep emotions high, you know, they have to move, you know, fast and produce fast. And all those things make for terrible information, you know, control,
right.
Make for terrible sophistication. So it's built into what the media is, especially in a hyper-capitalist media. You know, you can go to the lower levels of media and discover
podcasting. You
know, very, podcasting and, you know, sort of slow, thoughtful, expert, that kind of stuff. But even this, like, we're going to be talking here for an hour, and we both have, you know, long backgrounds in academics and experience with a lot of different things. And we're going to cover what, a 1/1000th of what we could cover, you know?
Yeah.
So it's difficult. The media, I'm not a media apologist, but I'm definitely a media realist. I did media studies a lot because I really like what TV and film can do. But
right.
Like, even like when you're talking about the masks earlier, the genius of user generated media and this mass social media is like, you'll see some of the things that came up. Like, I remember the first time I saw somebody breathing through their mask, you know, in the cold to show people the difference. You know, it was just a guy in his truck. He goes, you know why you should wear your mask? And he breathed, and then he put his mask on, you know, and you couldn't see his breath or whatever. And it's like, yeah, that's about what people need, you know?
Yeah, you know. That's brilliant. I also think that was a major failure of healthcare professionals at the beginning, not understanding, because we're so used to seeing people in masks, totally normalized. We're used to spending hours and hours in masks. Usually it's in a relatively controlled environment too, where, you know, surgical suites are very cold. You're not running around so much. And so we were just so used to that being a normal thing that you don't even... We didn't have that empathy again for people who are saying, wow, everybody's in a mask. This is creepy. This is weird. Which actually, interestingly, talking to some of my paranoid patients, they find masking much more comfortable for them because they're not seeing that whole
interesting
facial expression they're having digest. So that's just sort of a fascinating side trip that we'll take down. But and also, you know, what you have to say honest, because they'll say, oh, fine, I went running in a mask, it's totally fine. You know what? I can go walking in fine. I'm talking on the phone and walking briskly. I'm finding myself short of breath in a mask. And the thing is, I'm not actually short of breath. It's that I don't feel the air coming over my nose and mouth. And that's why people pull their masks down too, because it's much more comfortable to have your nose up so you can feel the air going in, and not just even understanding any of that and saying, oh, that's just stupid. It was a real failure in messaging from healthcare professionals and not understanding just, it's, you know, if I, again, everybody has this experience of feeling a little short of breath in their mask if they walk fast enough and talk fast enough. So.
Well, it does. It, like, this is I end up in the same space sometimes with getting people to slow down and look a little bit about what they're actually experiencing in these type of situations. It's a brand new social thing, having to wear masks everywhere. Nobody's done that. Nobody knows how to deal with it. Nobody knows how to deal with asking people to put a mask on if they don't have a mask on. There's all this stuff in there that hasn't been worked out, you know, over 50 years in a society, you know, like phones. You can figure out how to do a phone because you've been doing them your whole life and they've been around for, you know, 100 years. Suddenly masks break out. You have this very complicated social issue. And then, you know, you have people, and this is where we, like, when we were on Paleo Effects panel, I don't know if you remember this, but one of my bugaboos about working with other professionals has always been, none of you have training in rhetoric. None of you have been training in persuasion. Why are you doing persuasion without that training? You need it. And so I was on that panel, and like, it was me, you, and I think there's two other psychiatrists. And they introduced you guys, you introduced yourselves, and it got to me. And I'm like, well, I'm a rhetorician. You know, if you really want to sell paleo, America's advertising figured out how to do it. You know, look at Hooters, you know, sex, right, alcohol, and sports. Why are you trying to sell all this medical stuff and, you know, restriction of whatever? Just put better food in Hooters. And they're like, what? And I'm like, yeah. Because that's what a rhetorician would do, is like, I know how to persuade these people. I just want to change the food.
You know, rhetoricians are the ultimate pragmatists, I guess, is
whatever works. And within mindset, it's ethical only. Like, I don't do unethical rhetoric because I think it has all sorts of side loss. There's all sorts of, you know, side problems with doing unethical rhetoric. Like, the right does unethical rhetoric. It uses a lot of slander, a lot of deception, and you're seeing the payoff, like the slander, you know, going after the election and libeling, you know, the Dominion and libeling the, you know, people who ran the elections and all that. And they do it so well and so intensely. Now you're seeing it play out in something like the Capitol insurrection, which makes sense if people have actually been cheated. And so their rhetoric is extremely powerful, but it's also extremely unethical. And you can't have those two things combined. It's dangerous.
This is a very actually important piece of psychiatry, is ultimately we always have to remember that we are serving the patient and we cannot be serving ourselves. Because if you have a psychiatrist who is, you know, we're master manipulators. We're trained to do on a very personal level. It's a very private, very trusted interaction. And if you have a psychiatrist who lets that go, and there are some, you
Hannibal Lecter.
Become a cult leader. Well, Hannibal Lecter or that Romanian prime minister. And there are some sort of far right psychiatrists, anti-vax, who don't even believe in like the disease model of illness and things like that, who have whole bunches of followers, and they use all of these this manipulation skill that we have to get people to sort of to follow them and to worship them. And so that's actually a really important part of psychiatry, and really important, is that we and that that's also, you know, if you're just in the service of power or authoritarianism, then it's no problem for you to turn your rhetoric to lies and not care about it, not have any shame, and those kinds of things. And so it's a very powerful impact on the human psyche. We believe confident, well-spoken individuals. We're just trained, sort of indoctrinated to believe them.
Yeah, and I think this is the thing about business. You know, business is, capitalism is soulless. It doesn't have a morality system in it. It has a profit system in it. And we've always essentially expected capitalism to be a, you know, a social capitalism in this country that at least approximates a soul, you know, a conscience. But when you have somebody like Trump who comes in, who is just the total antithesis of that, pure profit, pure business, pure self-interest, and has zero, you know, care or connection about the people that he's, you know, sending these messages out to. For a long time, people have been, you know, after this rhetorically about, we should try a business person running the country. Tried it with Ross Perot, Steve Forbes. You're hearing rumblings about Mark Cuban now. But that, you know, a business person is amoral, they, by definition.
Right. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Unless they're not. Well, actually, my favorite comparison with these narcissistic personalities is actually Clinton and Trump, because both Bill Clinton and Donald Trump have raging narcissistic personalities. Right. Sure. Clinton was sort of always had to be the smartest person in the room, and was also had this, he managed to curb his narcissism. There's some deep corruption there, don't get me wrong, but he turned his narcissism to me, like, I am the only one capable of making the world a better place.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
And that kind of led him in some directions that I think were very successful for him, whereas Trump doesn't have any of that care about making the world a better place. Like, all he wants is his own. And so they both had a very severe personal cost and political cost in a way from their narcissistic personality. I don't think there's no politician. I mean, they do popularity contests for a living. All of them are going to have some narcissistic traits. And that's an example that I actually often use with patients, both on the right and the left.
Oh, that's great. Hey, that's a great example. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And both of them, their failures are from this deep insecurity / narcissism comes from a deep insecurity, right? It's not confidence. I think what's hard for me, as a clinician, as a psychiatrist, is it's very hard for me sometimes to see why people don't see that about Trump or even Clinton. That they just see almost this messiah figure. And I, on some hand, I get that, but it's very hard for me to deeply empathize with that, because it's so obvious to me how Trump's temperamental failures from the beginning would be catastrophic. And his lack of attention and all these deep character flaws that he have would be a terrible match for the presidency.
Because of the training, and everybody has this, you know, sort of the goggles and, you know, sort of filters that are strong from their repetitive activities. And so when you get trained in psychiatry, you see psychological traits in people. You know, with me as a rhetorician, I see the way people are trying to persuade. And so, you know, it's hard to look at that and not understand why other people don't have that same training. You know, and I do this a lot with sort of argument. So you get very complicated issues like the mask or whatever we're diving into. And I'm like, well, in order to make any headway on that, you've got to sort of lay it all out so that you can see what are the, you know, pros and cons on both sides. You have to understand them clearly so then you can therefore work through an argument. But that's just rhetorician, you know, logic training. You don't go into an argument until you know everything. That's just not good rhetoric. You know, you're going to run into stuff where you lose and have to improvise. And you never want to do that as a rhetorician. You always want to be the person who knows everywhere where you're going and can answer all the attacks. And so, like, when I see, you know, narcissism, and I see this a lot now, and I've always been fascinated by it, when psychiatrists are, I guess there's a rule, you're not supposed to diagnose public figures or people that aren't your patients.
Right. So you, this is,
but they're doing it anyway.
They can't stop them. The American Psychiatric Association has the Goldwater rule against, and I'm a member of the American Psychiatric Association, where I can't make a public diagnosis of people that I haven't sat down with, did a full clinical interview with, and then got their permission to talk about their diagnosis. And so for me, I sort of take this to say, look, you know, narcissism is a, there is a clinical diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, but narcissism is a trait, you know, isn't necessarily, you know, everybody has elements of it.
Sure.
So I can talk about that. I can talk about the fact that, you know, Trump isn't mentally ill. He's an asshole. Yeah, that's not a diagnosis to call somebody. And you know, people on the right, they love that he's an asshole. That's one of their favorite things about him. So, well,
this is why I'm always want to give, you know, even professionals more rhetoric training, because it gives you, it's like me going in and sort of rescuing some stuff from you from psychiatry, which I'll do because I just love it. You know, or sociology or philosophy, you know, rhetoric is just an amalgamation. Again, it's whatever is available. Can I use that? And so, like, I always want to give people rhetoric training because it expands some of their ability to explain these things that don't seem to make sense. So part of rhetoric is narrative theory, like who is telling a story that makes sense. And this to me is the dominant thing right now in public media and public talk about, you know, Trump, is that he's an anti-hero. You know, the same way that Bernie is an anti-hero. He's your Clinton versus Trump. Bernie versus Trump is the same thing. Bernie wants to, you know, go in and attack the system. He's coming from the outside. He's very aggressive about it. He's very, you know, vehement and emotional, and works really well with people who are outside the system and doesn't want to change the
system.
Trump is doing the exact same thing on the other side. He's an anti-hero, this kind of American who doesn't listen to anybody, goes with his instincts, always causing trouble. And you look at our history of our heroes in our media, how many of the men are that? Almost all of them. They're all rascals.
All the anti-heroes who are the heroes, you know, since The Sopranos and Six Feet Under, they started. And
Trump's perfect for that. You know, he's literally the first, from what I can tell, you know, Clinton had a little bit of that mischievousness to him, right? But he's the first clear anti-hero that I've seen get into that position. Reagan was a little bit like that, but Reagan was still, you know, kind of regal and refined and courteous. You know, Trump is just like, blow it all open and I'm here with my six guns a-shooting. So,
whereas the nice guys like Carter, you know, known as a terrible president, nicest guy, Dukakis, you know, I used to live in the Fenway, and I used to walk through the back bay fence down to the hospitals where I'd work. Dukakis lived in Brookline. I would walk down to the Capitol, so we would walk the opposite direction. So I saw Dukakis almost every day on my walk into the hospitals, and he carried a little plastic bag that he would pick up all the garbage that he saw along the way and put in the plastic bag. But he was genuinely this sweet man. This nice guy, and you can see why he was totally pummeled in that race.
It's so bad. Politics is a bad mix because it's two jobs, the same way teaching is two jobs. Well, it's actually four jobs, but I used to love to teach. You know, I love intellectualizing and I love talking in public. And I, you know, I like to help people move from, you know, ignorance, which I grew up in Kentucky, to, you know, some type of, you know, enlightenment. So I like all those processes, but then grading is horrific. It's the worst job ever, you know? And politics is the same way. There's, like you said, the publicness of it, learning how to win an election, and then governing is boring. You know, it's wonky, and it's like having to overcare, and it takes forever, and none of them want to do it. It should be two jobs. There should be people winning the election, and then you never hear from them again until the next election comes up. And then the people who govern, you're just like, let's put Dukakis in there to govern. He'll be
nice. I mean, I guess the right got it right in that, or the monarchist, right? You have the Queen of England, and you have the Prime Minister, whereas we have them combined, right?
Yeah, that's true.
I'm an American. I hate monarchy. Don't get me wrong, but you know that, and that was honestly what I think what I thought might have been Trump's being good was he would be more like George W. Bush, which would be let other people govern for him.
Yeah, if he'd have just gotten out of the way and just
Trump could have just let them do what they he would have been a 55% favorability president the whole time if he'd have just gotten out of the way. I mean,
well, and that's that whole, you know, business guy thing again, though. Like, they don't get out of the way. I've had to do right. I've run a marketing agency for 7 years now, and working with business people, a lot of them are super smart, a lot of them are super good people, but then a lot of them are just ego driven. Like, I'm like, you guys are making decisions because you've been told that you're an executive and that you should be able to make decisions. You don't know anything about what you're deciding. You're basically ruining your own company because you need to be the decision maker.
And I'll, you know, I'll talk to people too who lead companies, and I'm the only one who says, you know what? You're actually not really good at this part. take this really sensitively. This causes a great deal of anxiety. Why don't you outsource that part? You do this driven, the vision, whatever, but making these hard, you know, hiring people, firing people, it's not your thing.
Yeah. Well, and I think Trump, you know, Trump existed very well in the media environment for almost, 30, 40 years. For a long time, he was a clown. You know, he was well-liked. He wasn't, nobody hated Trump. They made fun of him, you know, for his hair and things like that. But everybody knew him. And then, you know, then they got him on the reality show. And I think it messed with his head. You know, they're telling him, oh, you're the greatest, you know, business person ever. And he started believing it. And then he tried to jump over into a bigger drama and headline a drama. And man, he was miscast.
Yeah. What I find, you know, sort of spectacular and also awful at the same time is that he could have gotten away with all of this. He could have gotten away with the tax stuff. He could have gotten away with there was no appetite for any kind of federal prosecution after he left. People wanted him, and then he had to incite a mob to sack the Capitol. You know, so he can be in the headlines for a few more years. It's incredible. I mean, it just doesn't stop. Yeah.
Well, and a guy like Trump, like, and business guys are like this, mobsters are like this. You know, anything that they have any power to use, they are going to use it. They don't think about consequences. You know, that's not the way that they're thinking. They're thinking like the pardons that are coming out tomorrow. You know, he's like, I've got a power here. I can sell something. There's no way I'm not going to use this, abuse it, absolutely. Whatever. Yeah. I'll just push it and they'll have to stop me. Like, I'm going to do this. Just make them stop me. And I don't know if we've ever had a politician like that. You know, again, that said, importing business or mobsterism, you know, into the presidency that blatantly. It's like, wow, just watch.
Yeah, not that blatantly. No, I don't think so.
They're usually like Nixon was at least shifty and hid things.
Right. No, they didn't say it in public, though. I had a Twitter thread about this before. It actually goes back to Texas history. There was a very corrupt governor, Ferguson, in the 20s, who was actually impeached and kicked out and wasn't even allowed to run again. Because he was so corrupt, but his wife ran and became governor, Ma Ferguson. She was eventually defeated by a populist celebrity who ran a radio show. His name was Papio Daniel. And he ran
from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh Brother, they moved him over to Mississippi, I think, for that. Yeah, yeah. He was actually a governor of Texas and a senator from Texas. And he ran a radio show, and he became famous as a flower salesman because they were selling flour for this radio show, and it was called Pass the Biscuits, Please, Pappy. And so he was elected to the governorship, served one term, then went to the Senate, got nothing accomplished because he wasn't a politician, didn't know how to govern, and eventually sort of faded into obscurity. He did defeat LBJ in his first, back then it was all runoffs, it was only the Democrats that mattered, right? So it was all the primaries and the runoffs and things. And he defeated LBJ by cheating. And LBJ said after this 1941 Senate runoff race that he was never going to be out cheated in the Senate election again. And so the next Senate election that LBJ won was by 200 or some odd very shaky, suspicious votes that surfaced 5 days after the election was over.
That's so great.
Like, all this stuff is happened before. You know, Trump is Papio Daniel. I mean, if you can go search that up in Texas history, Papio Daniel is Trump. I mean, it was just on a national scale this time.
And I think that's, you know, part of it too, trying to explain, you know, where this stuff comes from now, like the conspiracies and everything that's welling up. This is the first media environment, first time we've ever had this media environment, all of history of social media and instant distribution and no gatekeepers and, you know, highly produced media, you know, that can be done cheaply. You know, it's a whole new, you know, media landscape, but it's the same.
I think about it as a mass element of those people with the printing presses who came up with pamphlets back in the 1790s. You know, you had the pamphlets or the minister who would be the propagandist, and they could, who knows, you're some in little town in the middle of nowhere, your minister could be telling you all sorts of crazy stuff you wouldn't know any better.
Sure. And
so for a while, everything was sort of democratized, and then it was sort of all splintered, but at a much larger scale. And so I just think that that's interesting.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Well, this has been super fun. You've been talking for an hour. Like I said, you know, 1/1000th, there's all sorts of things to talk about. Right. Anything you would like to say to people, you know, before you go here, any kind of summary advice from the psychiatry world or anything that you'd like to promote or?
I mean, I would just reiterate that most of us on the right and the left, sure, there's some really horrible people who are terrible people who are racists or who, you know, complete anarchists who want everybody to suffer and watch the world burn. But actually, most of us are decent people who share the same values. And we just need to learn just kind of talk in the same language. And in order to persuade someone, you have to start with meeting them where they are. And you know, that's kind of taken a bad name, I think, and saying, oh, why do we have to listen to these diner interviews? You don't have to listen to the diner interviews. You just have to talk to your own family and your own friends and talk to them about where they are and listen from a space of knowing that they're basically a decent person. And I think that will get you a long way to be able to talk to people again.
Good advice.
Sit across the table at Thanksgiving.
Oh my God, Thanksgiving, the poor holiday. It's been so stressed out. It's the communication holiday. It's like we're so close to each other in one room and we got to sit here and eat and like, oh, this is going to be awful. So, well, thanks again. I appreciate it very much. Again, I try to find people that I have, you know, really interesting things to say, and I think you do. So I appreciate you talking to me.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be on the podcast. Good luck with the Rhetoric Warriors. It's a great project.
Yeah. I'm selling courses for $25 because I want everybody to take it. Like, you know, like this one, Converting Conservatives, is exactly this kind of stuff. Like, you know, how do you sit there and be effective across the Thanksgiving table without somebody, you know, hitting you with a turkey leg? So right. That's the goal. So thanks again. We will see you again next time on Rhetoric Warriors.
All right. Take it easy.